Hello. Welcome to whatever episode of Mood Swings this is. I'm not even going to try and guess anymore. I've given up. It's a grey Tuesday in Aberdeen, which is very rare at the moment. I mean, it's not rare in general, but at the moment it's been quite rare. It's been quite sunny, which you'll know if you live in Aberdeen or in fact Scotland. Scotland in general has been pretty good. And I'm just introducing my podcast with Rich Cadden. Rich is a two-time world Muay Thai champion. He's a coach. He fought and trained out in Thailand for a great deal of time, and he is also a mind coach, which you'll know a bit about if you've listened to my podcast with Liam Harrison, who Rich also trained with. And you know about Vinnie Shoreman. Rich has the same qualification as him and does a lot of the same work as Vinnie does, from what I believe. So yeah, if you like the Liam Harrison one, you're in for another big old treat, really. I met Rich. It all happened very sort of impromptu. He was through in Aberdeen doing some seminars. Well, a seminar and some PTs and stuff. I went to his seminar. Unfortunately, I couldn't get a PT because I had something on the next day. But I was lucky enough that I was able to drop Rich a message just after the PT. After the seminar, sorry. And he was available that evening to chat to me in his hotel, and so we went in the Aberdeen Travel Lodge. There were some lads getting ready for a night on the town, which I thought was going to be possibly a disaster, but we managed to tuck ourselves away in a corner and almost interrupted. Well, we didn't interrupt, but a family then appeared ready for a meal, and we had to move again. So it was an eventful night moving around the Travel Lodge bar. But I like that kind of thing when I'm recording podcasts. I enjoy that a little bit of having to make it work. It makes me remember it more, I think. What else have to tell you? Yeah, this is going to be a two-parter. It's the first two-parter in a while. I did hum and ha about whether I'd make it a two-parter or make it a long one-parter, but I thought, fuck it, we've not had a two-parter in a while. Let's divide it into two parts. Not much else to say, really. I've just been doing my time, so that's very on topic with this week's podcast. And I'm shattered. I've got to go do a live spot across at Spin tonight, which I'll be done by the time you hear this, so I can't even plug it. But it's been put on by previous guest Rebecca Clark. I just wondered if that was her name there. I speak to her all the fucking time. She's been on this podcast so many times, and I even questioned whether I got her name right. Molly McLachlan, Mehdi and Sangu, they're all there tonight, and one future guest as well, I believe. So it's going to be a very mood swingy night. I don't know why I'm plugging it after the fact, but there we are. I like to get on with the podcast now. Enjoy. Bar with Rich Cadden, an unlikely setting, but here we are.
Yeah.
How did you come about to be in Aberdeen for the weekend?
Chris Farman got in touch with us, and we've been doing a bit of work for a while. I've been up here and doing probably 5-6 seminars now.
Oh, cool.
So back before the Aberdeen Fitness Combat Centre had been kind of established.
Yeah.
I think the very first one was at Inchgarth Community Centre.
Okay.
Way back when.
Yeah.
And then I came down when he was down at the Arches.
Yeah, yeah.
And then a couple of times now up here at the main centre. So
yeah.
Yeah, it's staying in touch through Facebook and got in touch with it, so fancied another seminar. It's been a while since I've been up, so it's good to catch up with all my Scottish crew.
Must be interesting for you seeing how much the Aberdeen combat sort of scene has changed, like just from you coming up.
Yeah, massively. I mean, I think we did one of the seminars was also once at the Aberdeen Sports Village.
I think
there was like four or five different gyms that kind of clubbed together to get me up here, and we had maybe 70 in that seminar.
It was
absolutely epic, huge. It went really well, and so it's kind of growing year on year. It's good.
Even for myself, like, got the show coming up in a couple of weeks, the Aberdeen hometown show, and I didn't realise how many Thai gyms there were in Aberdeen, just from seeing the posters come up, and it's like, fighter from Aberdeen.
What club's that?
I just didn't realise there was as many clubs. It's one of those things. I think it's same in any city. Well, I found it seems like it's under the radar, almost like combat sports. Like, it's going on, but no one seems to.
I mean, it's certainly getting more and more, and say I run my own gym in York.
Yeah.
So you start picking up on the kind of advertising and marketing that a lot of the other gyms are doing and stuff like that. So it's good that it's getting out there now.
Yeah. Chock D Academies.
Yeah, Chock D Academy are on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. So we do a lot of work on social media. You start seeing what other clubs are doing and all the different shows that are coming around. So it's good.
How long has the gym been open now?
For Chock D?
Yeah.
Was established in 2005.
Okay.
It was literally just after winning my first world title out in Thailand. Came back, started to be a little bit smarter about my training, and I went down to the local fitness first. Got a personal trainer. Said like part of my induction and meeting some of the people down there. That was actually when I met my wife. She did my gym induction at the local fitness first. So it was we just kind of started going from there. Went out to Thailand, won my world title out there. Just started running classes out of the local studio.
Okay.
There. So that was like the start of it. I got made redundant from the railway in 2008.
So when you were fighting for world titles, you still had a
full-time job. Yeah. So had a full-time job as an engineer working on the railway.
Okay.
I was also a part-time student doing my degree part-time, just like one day a week, and then the rest of the time, studying and doing my work on a weekend and that kind of thing. So working up a mental sweat doing all my engineering work, and then a physical sweat doing all my Thai boxing work. So
it must be a lot to like juggle like full-time job.
Yeah. I mean it was hard work, but I had a lot of support from family and stuff like that, and I've always been a kind of really independent guy.
And certainly
spending the time going backwards and forwards to Leeds, training out a bad company,
fighting
out a bad company. All the bad company guys lived over in Leeds.
Yeah.
I was a kind of solo warrior back and forwards up and down A64 commuting over to Leeds. So that's how it kind of came about.
I always found myself like, so like before I did this podcast, I used to play in bands, and I used to write like a blog and stuff, and obviously now I do the podcast and I'm training Thai as well.
Yeah.
And people seem to like quite often get asked like, do you not think it's a bit much or like to detract from other areas of life? But the thing with me is that I've having other things to focus on outside my job maybe keeps me ticking over at work or whatever, when maybe that's not, you know, maybe not having the best day at work, having those things outside my own life.
Well, this is it. I mean, I do a lot of work kind of psychologically.
Yeah.
I'm an NLP practitioner, I'm a hypnotherapist, so I do all the kind of sports performance work.
Yeah.
But I also do a lot of reading into like traditional psychology as well.
Yeah.
And one of the things from there's a Hungarian guy. He's like his name's like like alphabet soup.
Yeah.
Mihai Csikszentmihalyi. Yeah. He wrote a book on flow. Okay. And flow is all about the psychological flow state that you get into. And sometimes, yeah, when you're doing a day job,
yeah,
you can kind of tick over with it, and it's like it's not really that much of a challenge. But following your passion, following your dreams, stuff that you do for free anyway,
yeah,
is kind of like that's where your passion is. So you get your recovery doing your day job, but then you can kind of chase your dream on a night time when you get home from work and you do it, you go after what you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, this was my thing. I really enjoy engineering. I like the problem solving of engineering, and then being able to work out the problem, set up systems and strategies behind that in order to either pass a message on from a coaching perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Or just work the system out for myself to be more efficient.
Yeah.
That's the problem solving side of things that I really enjoy.
Yeah.
So it's the crossover between the like mechanical world in engineering into the physical world when you're doing Thai boxing or as I'm now getting involved with it in the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and the wrestling and MMA as well.
Did you always approach Muay Thai with that sort of methodical mindset?
I mean, probably bordering on autistic, going down that route, not really emotional about it. Just saying, well, this is my goal. I want to be better. I want to improve. This is what I have to do. So, always kind of breaking things down and being methodical with my training. Like I was saying, when we first started with the gym at Fitness First, that kind of came about through almost like longer process.
Mm-hmm.
I was following kind of bro science and saying, well, okay, well, what do boxers do? Boxers do loads of road work, so I need to do loads of road work.
Yeah.
I turn up there and start training down there. One day I was on the treadmill and jogging away, pat my warm up, and this guy came on the treadmill next to us, and he starts running away, and I looked across, and he'd gone 1 mile an hour faster. Now this is where my competitive edge kind of kicked in, and I went 1 mile an hour faster than him. Then all of a sudden we're both kind of cranking it up. No eye contact was engaged. there was like a mutual kind of acceptance that it was now a race. So we were there both belting away until we were maxing out the treadmill and going up on the incline and everything. And after about maybe 4 or 5 minutes of this kind of racing, he kind of looked across, nodded, smiled. We had that good race, good run. We both kind of cranked down and got into conversation. It turns out that he was the lead coach of the local marathon running team.
All right. Okay.
Local athletics squad, and he does marathons. It was I think he's a Namibian guy, a black guy. Okay. He must have weighed about 55 kilos wet through. So he had that kind of marathon runner frame, and there was me kind of sprint against him and make it into a bit of a conversation. We started having a laugh and we got into a bit of a conversation, and so he was like, oh yeah, good running, well, what do you do? He says, oh, I do Thai boxing. He says, oh right, okay, says, you do a lot of running then? He says, yeah, I do loads of running. He says, oh, what kind of mileage are you doing? So at that time I was probably doing like 40 to 50 miles a week running.
Mm-hmm.
And he was gobsmacked. It was like, I'm a marathon runner and I don't run that volume of mileage. And I, And so this was like a really, really big wake-up call to me. Right, okay, well, I think we've kind of hit a glass ceiling of the benefit that I'm getting from just doing more road work.
Yeah.
So maybe I need to train a little bit smarter rather than just more. And then this is when I started pursuing some work working with personal trainers out of Fitness First.
Yeah.
There was a guy called Nigel Davis who was my very first personal trainer, and then I had a guy called Paul Swainson. Both guys have now moved on now, and I think Nigel's retired, but Paul's like one of the best fitness companies in the country now. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I was in good hands.
That treadmill thing, I think, is more common than you would think.
Yeah,
I've seen myself, like, you see yourself. Well, I feel myself doing it when I'm on a treadmill. Get the guy next to me, like, almost subconscious. It's almost like reassurance for me, just to check I'm actually running fast enough to know I'm doing something.
This is it. I think when you're if you're going out running just in the street, you try and catch people up. I think it's a kind of normal thing. But when you run on a static machine, you don't have that competition. So you look for little challenges. You always look to kind of push yourself a little bit more. And that's a bit of competition is always good.
Do you happen the other day for me? I think it was 2 or 3 weeks ago, and I was going. They normally have a Thai class on when the seminar would have been on today. So I was like, Saturday morning, I woke up halfway there. I was like, I'll go for a run down the beach before my class.
Yeah.
So I went out for a run, started running, and then I noticed off in the distance there's this massive crowd of people. Well, there was a running club out, wasn't there?
Right.
So they ran, like, I mean, there must be about 200-300 people in this running club, all different levels, you know, the kids at the back, folk running with prams, a massive thing, running along, and I was like, just felt dead awkward because there was me on one side running this way and then 200 people coming the other way.
So
I got to the end of the beach, turned around, you can kind of go down the steps onto the beachfront.
Yeah,
there's like a concrete walkway, and then run back that way.
Right.
Started doing that, realized they'd done the exact same thing, but in opposite. And they all come down, and it's even like a narrow walkway. I had to bail back up the stairs. It's just like only I could go out and run against a running club.
Okay.
How did you get into Thai boxing in the first place?
I've always been into martial arts. I mean, I started judo when I was about 7 or 8 years old.
Okay.
I was always a bit of a rough and tumble kid. Did judo when I first started, and then I was also playing rugby at the same sort of time. I mean, I've never been like a big guy, so on the rugby pitch, I always had to kind of stand up for myself, and I played scrum half, so I was right in the middle of the pitch against all the big prop forwards and second rowers and that. So it was always I always had my work cut out, and I had the odd kind of bump and bruise and getting dragged around by and tackled by these bigger guys, never really fazed me. And then as things kind of progressed and I got into Thai boxing, it was a bonus that I was fighting people my own size for a change.
So I
was kind of rubbing my hands together with the prospect of fighting someone my own size. So it was that's how it kind of started off. I've all kind of dabbled through like kickboxing, Aikido, Jiu-Jitsu, Taekwondo, Karate, and a few others.
Mm-hmm.
Probably stuck with kickboxing for the longest, which was around sort of maybe a year. That was like points kickboxing.
Yeah.
So like just making contact to score points. And then after that sort of maybe 14 months. One day I turned up to training and all the mats had gone, all the bags had gone and everything. And the other guy that was there was saying, well, I come down here because it's easier. I use this to complement my Thai boxing training. I says, all right, okay, well, what's this Thai boxing thing? He says, oh, well, I've got some pads in the car. I says, do you want to do some pad work? I says, all right. So I went up and got the pads out. I went over and started to do my kickboxing stuff, like point scoring stuff, points karate, points kickboxing. And I started flicking the pads and everything, and the guy was started getting more and more angry, and he was like, don't flick it, kick it like you mean it, kick it properly. And so I was like, all right, okay, well, what do you mean? Well, commit through and like turn your hip a little bit more and give us a bit of direction like that. Well, the first time I properly kicked pads was maybe like half an hour later, the 20 minutes, half an hour later, and I got goosebumps.
Yeah.
The very first time I was like, wow, I didn't realize I had this much mm-hmm. power inside of me. I got goosebumps and I was like, this is the real thing. This is the real shit.
Yeah, yeah.
This is proper. Like, it's not kind of this like universal like uber respectful kind of traditional martial arts type thing.
Yeah.
This is real fighting. This is as real as it gets. I mean, Muay Thai is the most extreme combat sport there is. I personally think that Muay Thai is more extreme than MMA mm-hmm. because there's the opportunity to tap out in MMA.
Yeah.
There's no tapping out in Thai boxing. You're in it for the long haul.
Yeah.
So, yeah. That's how I kind of first started off. Trained in York for the first probably 2 years. Trained under, there was a guy called Andy Wilby. Mm-hmm. That was the guy that I started kicking pads with.
Okay.
And then we found there was a guy called Pierre Mahon that still runs the Cal Loy gym from Harrogate. He was running classes out of the Barbican Centre, and it just kind of grew from there. I had about three or four fights for those guys. Said that I wanted to be competing more regularly.
Yeah.
Pierre said that he couldn't get me those kind of opportunities, but he knows a man who can. Took me over to the gym over in Leeds, trained at Bad Company. I mean, this is back when Bad Company was training out of St. Aidan's Church down.
I heard about this. I heard Andy Housen talk about this.
Down Hare Hills, and also at the gym where it's at now.
Okay.
So, I mean, yeah, that's kind of like where we started out, and just kind of grew from there. Then. Basically moved over and got more fights out of Bad Company, and the rest, as they say, is history.
So what sort of age were you when you first started competing?
I was probably 17, 18 when I was first knocking around in York and started training in York. I was probably 18, 19 when I first started going over to Bad Company, and I think I made the full transition over to fighting out of Bad Company full time probably when I was about 19, 20.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I remember like Andy Allison and Liam Harrison coming into the gym when they were, I think Andy must have been, he'll have been sort of, he was 16, 17 when he first started, he came in. And then Liam started a year or so after him.
Yeah.
So yeah, I've always been kind of in that circle, and it was a good little vibe. I mean, after a few years, I think Jordan Watson was already training when I first started, but he was probably 5-6 years old at that point, but still turning up to the adult classes and doing pad work and stuff like that.
Really?
So yeah.
I suppose it's paid off for him now.
Yeah, certainly.
So how long was it you were training before you ended up out in Thailand training and fighting out there?
I was pretty much straight away out there. Like
yep.
I had my I went over and I had like a year's sabbatical a 6 month sabbatical out of work, because I'd already planned to start kind of traveling
yeah.
around. I used to be really into my surfing, we had a 6 month round the world trip planned, like a gap year type
just
thing,
like all top sort of surf spots.
Yeah. Just going around. There's a famous surf movie called The Endless Summer. So you basically like follow the summer around the world. We went to LA, Hawaii, Fiji, New Zealand, travelled up the coast of Australia, Indonesia, over to Singapore, went up Thailand, came back down through Thailand, stopped in Malaysia, and then flew back out of Singapore. And this was like a six month traveling thing. But like I said, I just started doing the just started training Thai boxing at that point. So this is why we kind of chopped and changed the trip around to include Thailand, so that I could see what it was like.
Yeah.
And yeah, just kind of going out there and training with some of those guys straight away, turning up for my first sessions out there was fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was basically a year long thing. Like all my annual leave was spent going out to Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had like three really long stays out there, just like basically living out the gym. When I first started, this was when Jitty with my coach out there, he was still training out of Savarupin Gym, which is at the end of Khao San Road, like
okay.
the main kind of backpacker area. Then there was a bit of a fallout, and Jitty moved on to a couple of other gyms, and I basically kept in touch with him, followed him around, went to a couple of other gyms, got to train with some really really high level guys. I mean there was like Samco, Kit Montep, Nob Cow and people like that. Went out to Ingram Gym, and there was some got to train with some really high level guys. And then yeah, Jitty set up his own gym, and I've always been loyal with him, keeping that relationship meant that I got the kind of the closeness and the respect and the kind of continued training from him, which was fantastic.
Mm-hmm. So just for people listening, what is the main difference between training and fighting in Thailand as opposed to fighting and training in the UK?
It's a funny one. So like certainly in the UK, there tends to be more of a like an ego base.
Mm-hmm.
Tends to be more aggressive. I think in Thailand there's a more kind of sporting feel to it.
Okay.
Like an acknowledgement that it's just a rough sport, as opposed to in the UK, and we like to like grit teeth, get aggressive, and
yep.
turn it into a bit of a ruck, and you it brings a bit more ego into it, which is it's also for courses, it's like social norms and that kind of thing. Like over in Thailand, it's normal to, if people say, do you want to go down the park for a kickabout, they don't necessarily mean going down there to have a game of football. They could go down there and have a game of Thai boxing. It's just plain rough, whereas in the UK, you see people say, do you want to do some Thai boxing, they take it personally.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether that's a, like, whether it's an ego thing, whether it's a confidence thing, whether it's an acceptance thing, but there's certainly a different vibe.
I think it's also the media now as well, and the way combat sports is going in general. It's almost every, you don't hardly ever see a fight now, a big fight, that's not on some level being sold as a grudge match.
This is it. I mean, I think there's, the thing with social media and like WWE and stuff like
yeah.
that, people like a backstory. They like to have a good guy, they like to have a bad guy, and I mean it is what it is.
Yeah.
So I mean like when people are billed on shows over here, like a lot of promotions are linked to particular gyms, or they have a high proportion of fighters from one or two gyms or a local area.
Mm-hmm.
So it'd be like Leeds versus the rest of the UK, or York versus the rest of the UK, or whatever.
Yeah.
So you get the kind of hometown support, which is always a bit of a benefit.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're the alternative, when you're going into someone else's backyard, then you know you're in for a fight, because you're not only fighting the guy in front of you, but you're fighting the kind of the biases that are going to kick in
yeah.
when everyone cheers when your opponent kicks, but no one cheers when you kick. Mm-hmm. You're kind of fighting against that, so there's a certain level of credibility required by the judges, and also for you to know and allow your confidence to build when you do score and keeping it in a level fight and an even fight and certainly getting and working towards your win.
Yeah, you were saying in the seminar today the scoring is different in the UK than it is to Thailand.
I think there's a as we were saying with the fights, I think there's certainly a different feel and a different vibe to it. Whereas, like the work that's been done by the IBMTO with the tuition by Tony Myers and Darren Phillips and all the other crew that are working on the IBMTO. What they're doing is keeping the scoring criteria correct.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Tony's done loads of work with some high level judges over in Thailand, and they're able to kind of carry the story through, and the message doesn't get lost in translation. But as the kind of Chinese whispers of this gets passed on,
mm-hmm.
there's a different understanding. So there's inverted commas scoring body kicks where you make contact with your shin across someone's body and there's assumed effect.
Okay.
In proper Thai boxing, in Thai boxing, the two key words are balance and effect. Everything that you need to throw is in balance,
mm-hmm.
and then also you need good effectiveness in order to warrant your score.
Mm-hmm.
The assumed effect thing, that comes because the majority of Thai guys kick ridiculously hard, even when they're just trying to place it. It's not a social, it's not like a norm for a Westerner to be a good kicker unless they've built up that neurology and that physiology,
yeah.
in order to deliver the kick hard. So people kind of exploit the rules and they exploit this kind of a scoring body kick. You don't need to see effect, it's assumed effect.
Okay.
So
yeah.
So some people kind of get away with it. And you can come up against fighters that know that if they lift their leg up and then everybody cheers, they're going to be scoring with it.
Mm-hmm.
For me, it still doesn't work that way. You still need to see effect. At the end of the day, it's still a fight. And there's scoring criteria and scoring body kicks, and then there's effective body kicks. The key word is effectiveness.
Mm-hmm.
So this is where the Chinese whispers starts getting kind of twisted and contorted. Because you don't need to see visible effect when a body kick is landed.
Yeah.
Because there's assumed effect there. Well, you still need to be kicking harder, and it's a difficult task to assess whether someone's just lifting the kick fast or whether they're lifting the kick powerfully. And I think this is where a lot of the scoring criteria gets fudged and changed. Also on the back of that, in the West, in the UK and across Europe, people like to see a fight. They like to see the aggression. They like to see people winning a fight by being on the front foot, because they don't see it as a game. They
yeah.
see it as a fight.
Yeah.
So they like to see someone being aggressive, and then they will favour the more aggressive guy,
yeah.
because he's working more but aggression and going forwards isn't part of Thai boxing scoring criteria.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard for some people to kind of get that idea and concept out of their head.
Yeah. So it's, but then from the Thai fights I've watched, like boxing over Thailand, it doesn't seem like they're less violent, although there's maybe less, like, I don't know how to describe it, like, I've seen the Thai guys go like hell for weather with
each
other.
Yeah. I mean, that's not to say that the Thai guys don't get aggressive. They're assertive over their aggression, but they're also patient.
Okay.
This is why that patience kicks in when you understand the scoring criteria. So this is why people say, like, first round, it's kind of slow and you're expecting a draw and the people don't score the first round and all these misnomers. Every round gets scored.
Yeah.
But because the fight is judged as a whole, you don't start off like a steam train, because you might get carried into deep water later on when you start getting tired, and then end up losing the fight at the end.
Yeah.
However, the developments that people are now making with strength and conditioning coaches, and the ridiculous level that fighters' fitness is now getting to, people can sustain that for 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think there is a slow but sure tweak happening within the, like, evolutionary development of Muay Thai fighters. Because if you look now, people that are training as full-time fighters, I mean, look at, I'm trying to think of the, like, look at Liam's last fights.
Mm-hmm.
Liam Harrison, he's training as a consummate professional. He's got a strength and conditioning coach. He's in the gym 2-3 times a day, preparing for his fight, and he couldn't sustain that mad intensive, almost rabid dog level of enthusiasm,
mm-hmm.
for the 15 minutes and weather the storm. He's also very good at wearing a mask and not showing when he's tired as well. So this is part and parcel of what you learn as a fighter and as a coach, being able to assess when people are getting tired. And I mean, one of the things for me as a coach now is that if my guys start showing me that they're tired, I'll blast them out with 10 kicks.
Yeah.
As a punishment for showing me that they're tired. Well, I'm going to push even harder now.
Yeah.
Well, okay. This is like I said. This is part of it, and you soon learn not to show expression. You learn certainly not to show any pain. You learn mm-hmm. to, like, bite down your gum shield and kind of set your face, and like wear that impenetrable mask. So you're like Ivan Drago and Rocky. it's like,
yeah.
Bam! I've hit him with my best shot, and all I've seemed to have done is piss him off.
Yeah.
I haven't hurt him in any way. Well, yeah, it probably has hurt him. He's just wearing a really good mask.
Mm-hmm.
All right, okay.
That's part of Thai culture with Thai boxing as well, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
So I know that you recently started your own podcast as well.
Yeah.
What's that called, and where can people find it?
It's on the Anchor app.
Okay.
So basically. I heard about it through Gary Vaynerchuk,
okay.
The social media guru. he says people should just get content out there, get the mm-hmm. message out there. You can download an app, it's on Anchor, and just start podcasting. And I was like, what's this Anchor app that he's talking about? So I went onto my Play Store, found Anchor, downloaded it. I was podcasting in the next 30 minutes.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So it was just kind of in at the deep end, and just basically me chatting shit and telling stories and just kind of getting my message out there. Some of the stuff is like from a coaching perspective. Some of it's just kind of reporting on fights, having coaching experiences, stuff that's happened in lessons which have been like light bulb moments when mm-hmm. when people have had that kind of aha moment where, like, trying to figure out what technique is or whatever, and then also some kind of psychological stuff as well, how to, like, generate flow state and how to approach sparring. That's probably one of the good ones at the moment. So mm-hmm. And one that I've done just recently is one on bit of self-defense stuff, because not only am I doing work out my gym, I have like two or three like little satellite gyms around
okay,
as well.
Cool.
And I work out at the local private school doing doing all the combat sports as well. So
oh, cool.
Yeah, I'm a busy guy.
Yeah. Just want to get back to that psychological element of speaking about that for combat sports, because what I don't know if I've ever told anyone this other than my girlfriend, but what actually made me first interested in boxing and which led on to doing Thai boxing was I went to see that film with Jake Gyllenhaal, Southpaw.
Right.
I don't know if you've seen
it. Yeah.
But it was
pretty
much it was the first time I think in my adult life that I'd watched like a proper boxing film in years. I went to see it because Kurt Sutter, the writer, had written a show that I really liked, so I just kind of went to see it. And I remember thinking, like, what the fuck must it be like to go through all that, like days and hours of hard training for a fight, then you could get sparked out in 2 minutes, or you could spark the other guy and get it in two minutes, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that was what first got my brain ticking about it. But then, ignorantly, I thought, I must be the only person that's gone into boxing thinking about that side of it, that just wants to know what it feels like. I thought everyone else wanted to go and, like,
Going back even into like Greek history and stuff like that people have been saying about like a man doesn't know that he's really alive until he's had a fight and the capabilities of the human body when put under duress. I mean like back into like the original Olympic Games and stuff like that, they had pancreas, they had the wrestling, they had and all that kind of like hand-to-hand combat stuff. Yes, okay, it may not be like strictly martial arts, but it's hand-to-hand combat and people used to die, so it's as rough and as real as it gets. I like the crossover between the almost sometimes fighters get labelled as thugs or thick idiots if you don't know how to like string a sentence together, and people start getting punch drunk and this that and the other, and almost look down on this like pugilistic dementia.
Yeah.
But there's a famous quote about separating your policymakers away from your warriors. Means that the warriors lack the intellect and the policymakers become cowards.
Okay.
Because they're like always in fear.
Yeah.
But if the policymakers know that the warriors are working together, then people the warriors stay smart and the policymakers stand strong.
Yeah.
It's this kind of Greek level of philosophy about it. So getting back to this idea of it's not a new phenomenon,
mm-hmm.
far from it. I mean, ever since like from the start of time, like people have been wanting to have people have this like group and like gang mentality, like clan mentality, and that kind of thing, and people have fallout. So yeah, there's obviously kind of wars and battles and things like that, but
mm-hmm.
end of the day, like hand to hand is the most raw and realistic form of combat.
Mm-hmm. And what is it about the mental game of combat sports that you think is so important? Because like with the seminar today, and just I listened to the podcast that was How to Approach Sparring.
Yeah,
I really enjoyed that point. Listening more, what is it about that mental side of it that makes you really want to talk about that?
I mean, from a mental perspective, it's a lot of the time it's the confrontation of fear.
Mm-hmm.
Regardless of whether you're 6'5", 17 stone, ripped to shreds, and you can squat 300 kilos and deadlift the same, benching 200 kilos and this that, and the other. It doesn't matter how big your muscles are, people still have the same psychology.
Yeah.
Sometimes people like focus on this side of fitness to compensate for their insecurities in other areas.
Yeah.
Regardless of the framework that the person is in, everyone still has the same mental processes going on. I mean, I'm a sports psychologist as well, so looking at the kind of sort of mental performance work through my NLP qualifications and that kind of thing, you get to have these like in-depth conversations with athletes at all levels in all sports that still feel that same kind of performance anxiety. And so being able to control that and harness that and use it in a productive format is what intrigues me.
Mm-hmm.
You get guys that come in the gym and they're like automatic. You tell them how to do a technique and they'll do it straight away.
Yeah.
However, put them in front of someone that's going to hit them back and everything goes out the window. Where's that seated in? This is one of the kind of big issues that I have when I'm coaching is that you'll see people perform fantastically, not under pressure.
Yeah.
But then that kind of fight or flight psychology kicks in and that like wide spectrum of techniques gets narrowed down to this like jab, cross, hook, low kick, body kick, like ABC type sparring.
Yeah.
It's like, well, why is it when he's on the pads that he's got the freedom and athleticism to do all these kind of jumping, spinning back kicks and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah.
When in actual fact the scope is there. Mm-hmm. They've got the scope, they've got the neurology, they've got the message. But they can't do it under pressure. So this is what I call the three F's. You've got fight, flight, or freeze. Nine times out of ten, people freeze. People panic so much that they don't want to do anything. So, and when they don't want to do anything, they basically turn into a victim. They turn into someone that doesn't do anything, and therefore they lose. Or they turn into the person that fights. And then all of a sudden, this meek, mild person that's been tapping away on pads turns into this phenomenal, like sparring monster. Starts banging away and hitting people hard and overcompensating in their sparring, because they're because of fear.
Yeah,
and so. This is one of the things that I've kind of found intriguing, and this is what led us into getting it more involved in the psychological side of stuff.
Mm-hmm. And when did you decide to get your qualifications for hypnotherapy and for sports psychology and all that stuff?
I started when I was at the railway again. Back when I was an engineer. One of the most common things that I had through my like annual reviews was you could always be a better communicator.
Okay.
So they kept on putting me on all these different like communication courses and such, critical communication and this, that, and the other. Using safety critical language and this kind of stuff, but even through that, they were still telling me that I still needed to improve my communication, so I couldn't quite put my finger on what it was. Then it was through a conversation with Vinny Shorman, that he said that he was doing his NLP practitioners, and so I said, oh well, what's this? Neuro-linguistic programming. Neuro to do with the brain, linguistic, the language that we use, program, like the systems and structures that we use to perform in our everyday tasks. Okay, so that sounds interesting.
What's it like?
How can we... Hello? All right, so I'll ask work and see if we can do this course.
Yeah.
All right, so put the course to them. Work said, no. long and short of it, we ain't got the budget, we can't afford to do it. Says, okay, this is something that I really want to do because it's something that keeps on coming up. You're not feeding me the the education to beat this like communication issue that allegedly I've got. It's now become an issue with me, so and I want to crush it. It became like a bit of a kind of goal setting thing. So says okay. If you won't do that, then if it's a budget thing, I'll go 50-50 with you.
Mm.
No. Right. Okay. Wow. All right. Okay. Will you give me time off to do the course? Yeah. All right. Okay. So I'll pay for the course myself, and I'll put myself through it, and I'll do all this stuff alongside. So signed up for the course. There was about 6 books to read, 20 odd hours of CD learning to like 20 hours of lectures to listen to, and then like a pre-course exam to get accepted onto the course. So it was a high level intensive course. So I got all the pre-course material, got the manuals, started understanding about representational terms, how everyone has different learning styles and things like that. Some people are audio, visual, or kinesthetic. So, and in the manual, there was a list of words. There was a list of like all the auditory terms, all the visual terms, all the kinesthetic terms. So, because I spent a lot of time answering questions on the phone from these people, from some of the like engineers in the field and stuff like that, I taped it in front of my telephone on my desk, and so as I was listening to them on the phone, I was listening to what they were saying, but I was also trying to identify what their representational system was.
Mm-hmm.
So are they looking for audio, kinesthetic, visual, audio, kinesthetic style language? Okay, so visual, you can't believe what I can see, or I can see this, I can see that, I can see that there's something hanging off, or blah blah blah.
Mm-hmm.
Or in the auditory terms, there's I can hear a knocking coming from the engine, it just doesn't sound right, and all the different kind of key descriptive words. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I get the feeling that something's not quite right. I feel a little bit uncomfortable. Again, going back to the representation system. So I started using that, answering the phone, picking out that, and then it was like click of the fingers. All of a sudden, I was connecting with people.
Okay.
I was connecting with people, and I was able to stay in their same representational system. I was able to speak their language, and I was getting radically different results by just using the right adjective,
mm-hmm.
which was confusing, fantastic, and amazing.
Yeah.
So this is just how it started. So if I can make that much of an impact with this one little gem of knowledge, what's it going to be like when I finish the course? I've just kind of gone from strength to strength with it, understanding these communication models, understanding these different mentalities, understanding how different people click, and then it makes you a more effective communicator.
And a more effective coach, I would have thought.
Exactly.
Well, that was part one. If you enjoyed it, then I'm really glad, and you've got a whole treat coming up. If you're enjoying these combat sports, mental health, crossover podcasts, you've got some cool stuff coming up. I recorded one with Cage Warriors Ross Houston, and I'm hoping to record a couple more. I don't want to say much more about it. Sort of link to that one, and release like a series of mental health combat sports goodness. I'm really enjoying recording those ones. Like, it's a fresh angle on the whole thing. I think quite often you get different stories, just like it is recording with anyone, I guess, but For me, I like I think I said earlier on, I wanted to do a lot of sports people, and yeah, I've really enjoyed recording those ones, so I hope you're enjoying and hearing them. Part two with Rich will be up when it's up. It'll be, of course, this week. It might already be up by the time you're listening to this. But I have got an incredibly busy week, as seems to be every week these days. Next week's podcast, I'm not sure who it's going to be. I've kind of built up a few now, and a few really good ones, so it's hard every week to pick which one I want to put out and let you guys hear. I want to try and mix up, because I've been, like I say, been doing a lot of the combat sport ones, so I don't want to, if maybe those aren't your thing, or you maybe enjoying those podcasts but you're not like the combat sports, it's maybe getting a bit much listening to all those if you can't really relate to them yourself there. I don't want to like overload you with that sort of stuff, so I'm trying to divide them up, even though I have been recording quite a few of those ones after spending a long time not getting as many people, as many athletes as I would have liked. But anyway, I hope you're enjoying it. Your feedback is as always appreciated. I did a wee poll on Instagram this week and voting what people want me to put out, so if I get it between two podcasts next week, I might do that again. Apologies to everyone who missed out who put the musician / DJ. Maybe I'll stick that one out next week to appease you guys. But I won't reveal who it is just yet. Well, you might know, I think it's probably already on Instagram somewhere, isn't it? I forget these things. Right, I'm rambling now, and I really need to go and get this podcast edited down and get along to spin tonight. Thanks to all of you for listening. If you're a new listener because you're a fan of Rich, sorry, really should have said this at the start. If you're a new listener and because you're a fan of Rich and a fan of Muay Thai, but you've enjoyed this and you want to listen to more of what we've done, as I say, we've got the Liam Harrison one. We're probably going to have more Muay Thai ones coming out. We've got MMA ones. Definitely more MMA ones coming out. So if that's your bag, go and check out our previous episodes. And you can catch us on social media, facebook.com/365Aberdeen, because it won't let me change the name, as I say every week. And on Twitter, it's also 365Aberdeen, just for continuity. And to throw continuity out the window, it's moodswingsabs. So moodswingsabz, all one word, on Instagram. I have a Tumblr too, can't fucking remember what that is. No one uses Tumblr, but normally I put a Tumblr post up anyway. I share the link on all the other ones, so you'd find it anyway. Right, cheers, and come back for part two. I think part two we talk more about the mental health side of it. The first sort of half I felt was about getting Rich's story. So yeah, come back for part two. Cheers.